Very good. So welcome today. It's nice that you've been talking to one another, getting some fellowship, feeling friendly with one another, feeling safe. All really good people here. But from now on until 9:30 tonight, except if you go out first for lunch, try and be quiet. For those who have trouble keeping your mouth shut, we do have some masking tape available. We put a little hole in there with a straw, so you can always have something to drink, and your food will be liquid, so you can keep your mouth. Okay, and one person who can't. Oh, sorry. Okay, say something.
In the corner, but feel free to come and take the chair and put it in a convenient place where
you can
actually hear. Thank you.
There we go. So, those of you who are here, please try and keep quiet, because if you're going to make your mind peaceful, not having to deal with people's conversations helps. Maybe sometimes people come up and talk to you, and then you sort of start thinking about what they say, more business in the mind. You were trying to get the mind to be calm and peaceful. And stillness outside is really helpful. But when we ask you not to be, and not to speak, please don't be stupid. If you see there is a fire in the building, please don't. Just say fire. Because sometimes people take silence to its extreme and become ridiculous. So it's okay to say, someone's looking for the toilet, because there are toilets over there. That is allowable, that's fine. You just don't get into conversations. After 9:30, you can speak as much as you like. And after the retreat tomorrow.
9:30 tonight.
Okay, not 9:30 now. It's after 9:30 already. No, after 9:30 tonight and after 5:30 tomorrow, you're most welcome. You can speak as much as you like. You've done so much talking in your life. It's nice to be silent. Because when you're talking to others, you're not listening. You can't be doing two at the same time. An example was, I was in the monastery where I live in Australia, and one morning I was passing the kitchen just before lunch, and there were five people cooking food for the monks and the whole community that morning. There were five Thai people, and I looked through the window of the kitchen and I saw every one of those five women, there's only five women in the kitchen, with their mouths open talking. And being a former mathematician, I began to consider, if five people are talking and only five people in the room, there's no one left to do the listening. What a waste of time all that talking is. And it's so true. Too many people do the talking, not enough people do the listening. And especially here, you're going to be listening to your body, listening to your mind, listening to the truth of the world. And if you've got a conversation going on between your ears, you can't hear anything. So when we actually start to restrain the speech coming out of our mouth, it's much easier to restrain the speech between our ears. And there's an old meditation trick which will tell you exactly what I mean. Because sometimes actions speak louder than words. Examples which you can feel are much more powerful than any words can describe. So this little exercise, I want you not just to listen to my words, I also want you to be mindful of your reactions inside. Because as I'm speaking, you will begin to notice many pauses between my words. In those gaps, what was happening inside your mind? There it was again. Silence. Knowing without thinking anything. The reason was because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. Because of that, you were quiet, paused, listening, feeling, knowing, instead of this constant chatter inside. So the outer silence supports the inner silence. And after a while, the inner silence becomes so beautiful. I remember many times just going into forests, into caves, where there was no sound at all. Many years ago, that would have been 1982, I think. I went to visit that monastery in Sussex, Chithurst, during the winter time. Trying to visit my family for Christmas. I've been there for about 8 years. And that monastery was still being built. It was still freezing cold. And that one time in 1982-83, the temperature dropped in Sussex to -26°C. Now I know in places like Norway that's like, you know, warm, that's temperate. But I really knew that I was just really cold. And because I was a visitor with no duties, I just in the morning after breakfast, I put on all the robes I had and went out into the thick snow in the early morning. They have a saying that only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. They have another saying, only mad Australian monks, and not even dogs go out at that time. Well, I went out there, and it was magic. No other person had gone out from their houses that time of the morning. All of the animals and the birds were hibernating. There was no sound of any traffic. No cars could get through that snow. And I was totally alone in that forest. And when I stopped walking, when the crunch of the snow under my boots stopped, now the whole world stopped. There was silence. Not a word. Not a movement. Not a rustle of any leaves. That was magic. I'll never forget that. Silence. I also, in places like Thailand, go into these deep caves. So deep that there can be a thunderstorm, as one day there was outside. You couldn't hear it inside. And inside those caves, everything stopped. It was still silence. That, again, was magic. The magic of silence and stillness. And in fact, I had a poem as a translation of a Chinese proverb, and if I can remember it correctly, learn to be silent and you'll realize you've talked too much. We all have, including me. When you're silent, what do we need with speech? Silence says everything. And silence is a beautiful place where we can rest. I love silence. If any of you come and visit me in my monastery in Australia, you will always be taken to my cave. It is my bedroom and the top tourist destination in that district. It's a beautiful. People go there, come and see your cave, and we're okay. And sometimes I have to wait until everyone gets out before I can get in. It's my cave, it's my bedroom, where I meditate. But anyway, I don't mind sharing it. And they go in there and there's no noise at all. Total silence. That's beautiful. That is where you can hear the outer silence. It soaks into your mind. And your mind automatically becomes still. And that's not scary. That is so freeing, so liberating, so peaceful, so beautiful. Peace outside becomes peace inside. Oh, that's great. So that's why we try not to speak. To try and engender, encourage, and build up more peace outside so it goes into our mind and becomes really, really deep peace. Now during these few days, it's only a couple of days, it's not that long. So it's not much to ask you to be quiet for a few days. And I'm not going to force it. Don't be afraid that, you know, if you get caught talking, you're going to have to stand in the corner with a duchess out on top of you. I just really, discipline has to come from within, never from without. But that happened to me at school, knows all these rules. And when I broke the law, you got punished. You know, all I ever learned from that was not to get caught again. I didn't understand why I was being punished. All I understood was, don't do it again, or rather, don't get caught. I never understood why we should do these things. Now, speed cameras in England, all you really understand is actually where they're located. So you can always know that when you see they're coming close. You don't realize what they're there for. So this is why, in this retreat, I want you to understand why. Not from fear, but from wisdom. And it's wise to be quiet. But once you're quiet, and the whole hall here becomes a place of quiet, it makes meditation so much easier. Because instead of paying attention to what the other person is saying, or what you're going to say next, your brain has more capacity, you're freeing it up to be more aware of what's going on. When you close your eyes and sit still, you're more capacity in your brain, literally more gigabytes between your ears, to be able to feel the world, to be able to know your body, to be able to be aware of your mind. Where is your brain? Oh, your body. Welcome. When you know your body, when you know your mind, that's where the wisdom starts to come. And when, as I said last night, the more you become still, the more the mindfulness increases. The mindfulness is like the gatekeeper, which can always see what's going on and actually make adjustments to the posture, make adjustments to the body, make adjustments to the mind, to get deeper and deeper into stillness. Silence. Stillness. When nothing moves. You know, years ago, when I was a lay person, you know, working or doing business in London, London was such a busy city. There was always places of silence I could go. You know, one of my favourite places I'd head towards just to have a rest, a little meditation, was Westminster Abbey. That was my little hidey hole. Because it was such a vast, you didn't have to pay and queue up to get in those days, you just walk through the door. And it was quiet. I remember just before I went to become a monk, I was doing visas, really tired, busy, stressed. And so I went into the cathedral. Just to sit down somewhere in the quiet, in the silence, and rest. And I was just so disappointed, like a dagger to your heart. Someone had installed a PA system. Constant announcements, and then tight sermons coming out. There was no quiet at all anymore. The silence, which for me was the sacred, had been destroyed. You know, we live in such a noisy world. And there must be some places, please, where you don't have PA systems. Where you can sit just quietly and rest and relax. The great French philosopher and mathematician Louis Pascal, in 1600 and something, He said all the problems of mankind, language is gender specifically, so that means all the problems of people kind, come from not knowing how to sit still. I thought, wow, that fellow had hit onto something, which every Buddhist would say, sadhu, 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 well done. All the problems of humankind come from not knowing how to sit still. And I would say, wow, many health problems come from not knowing how to sit still. Too much agitation, too much worry makes the problem worse. All the problems between families, not knowing how to sit still, because when you sit still, you see things from another perspective. From kindness. So this is one of the reasons why it's great, wonderful, to teach people how to sit still. Now how we do that, a bit of silence is important. And as I was saying yesterday, please look after your bodies. Please be kind. For those who are straight down the line Buddhists, you'll know it's called middle way. One of those extremes is called Atta, Ginamata and Yoga. And it literally means doing practices which tire yourself, which exhaust yourself. And this is what the Buddha said straight away, please look after your body, keep it energized, eat well, sleep well, you know, wash, so your body is fit, healthy, ready to go when you meditate. So that's why, please sit comfortably. Please don't force your body. I've known many people, there's one monk, lives in the north of England, in a big monastery over there, but I won't say his name. I think many of you know who I'm talking about. But I grew up with him in Thailand, he was a monk, I made just a little bit senior to him just by a few months. And he decided, you know, one of these enlightenment or bust ideas, he was going to sit all night without moving. Just like they say in the sutras, even though my blood dries up, even though my bones turn to dust, I will not move until I get full enlightenment. And he tried that. After a few hours of agony, we had to take him to the hospital where he had a double knee reconstruction. I remember that. That was stupid. That was dumb. What are you doing that for? So this is actually something with my meditation technique. I just strengthen the Buddha. For goodness sake, care for your body. Don't force it. Don't go sitting longer than necessary. And what is necessary, only you could know. During this retreat, try and keep it nice and relaxed. If you feel you sat too long, get up and get out. Or move the posture, or just open your eyes, do something, but don't keep forcing your body. Number two is if you feel it's not long enough. Just keep your eyes closed, don't have to listen to me. You don't have to go out for lunch, you can still stay in here during the lunch period. You can get lunch later on, you can get dinner tonight. What's the big deal? If you're enjoying it, carry on. This is wonderful, keeping it natural. When the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, he didn't have bells. Time to get up, time to walk, go back, sit down. It was purely natural. When his body felt like he wanted to meditate, it did. When it was said enough, he got up. Please do not force. You do not defeat defilements or hindrances through force, through endurance, through willpower. They overcome through wisdom, power, and kindness. Again, this is for those devout Buddhists who know all of the teachings. Remember how the Buddha became enlightened? And Mara, this symbol of temptation, came up to him. And the Buddha didn't punch his lights out. The Buddha said, I know you, Mara, wisdom. And Mara had to leave. The obstacles are always overcome by understanding them, not through fighting them. So don't fight your body. This is not the US Marines. This is Buddhism. Kind, compassionate, and incredibly powerful. So, look after your body. So, people sometimes say, well, I sometimes have an itch somewhere, then scratch for goodness sake. You got a pain? Move. You got a cough? Cough. You've got saliva in your throat? Dribble. let it go, let it be. Sometimes people often ask me that, they say, what happens? I've got trouble with saliva. The only trouble you have is because you make a big deal out of it. Just swallow, just dribble, so what? Most people don't dribble, just swallow. And after a few moments it just disappears, no problem at all. If you really have a problem with saliva in your throat when you're meditating, it doesn't cost that much. You get one of those little things they use in the dentist. And really, and that was lovely, all saliva. I can't resist those stupid things like that. So look after your body. And then afterwards, as I said yesterday, don't go on to your whatever meditation object it is. Just look at your mind and relax it first of all. In the Anapanasati Sutta, this is called establishing mindfulness before you meditate. Many people who meditate, they make a big mistake of going onto their breath or whatever too soon. Which means you can't really watch the breath, you're not ready yet. You're too restless. And so what people do, they rush the breath, they grab hold of it, they're using force, trying to will their mind onto the breath, and they get frustrated, it doesn't work. Use wisdom, have a relax first of all. And then also, if you want to do the Rolls-Royce method of meditation, don't even try and watch anything. There's something I said, I think it was yesterday at Jamyang, is I always like to try and bring basic Buddhism into meditation, because I've seen that some people meditate one day and they reject all the Buddhist principles while they're meditating. Fighting, forcing, no kindness, craving for something, no letting go, and they think that's meditation. And they get stuck. So, instead, there's a little method which I developed from one of the old stories I read as a student, which I mentioned in my first book. It's called The Emperor's Three Questions, Method of Meditation. The Emperor's Three Questions was a great little simile for life. Emperor didn't like religions at his time, wanted to make his own religion, centered it on getting the answers to the three most important questions of life. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? And of course, we all know the answer to the first one. Now is the most important time. Only time we have. And in meditation, please follow that. It does not matter what's happened next. What happened before, sorry. Doesn't happen what's going to come next. Stop trying to aim for things. You're forgetting them now. The future is more important than what you're experiencing. Now is the most important time. The most important person in the atmosphere question is always the one right in front of you. In meditation, it's the experience you have right in front of your mind, right now. What are you aware of right now? Give that importance. It may be tiredness, restlessness, pain, whatever. Please give it importance. And the third question is, what's the most important thing to do when you see someone? Care for them. What's the most important thing that doctor should do, which I mentioned last night? Care for your patients. Don't try and cure them. What's the most important thing a meditator should do with what's right in front of them? Care for it. Don't try and cure it. Don't think, this is a defilement, I must cure it. This is an obstacle, I must overcome it. Care for your defilements. Care for your obstacles. Be kind to them. That undermines them. And they vanish. So I love that way of meditating. It makes it so simple. And it answers the question which I got, I think last night or yesterday. Who said, Can people with mental problems meditate? And I say yes, and that is how. Now the most important time, because someone with schizophrenia, someone with bipolar, someone who's depressed, can they do that in the present moment? Yeah, a bit of training to do that. Whatever you're aware of right now, can you give that importance? Of course you can. Can you care? Of course you can. When you ask them, can you watch the breath? No. Can you sort of sweep the body? No. But can you care for what's right in front of you now? Of course you can do that. And this is the essence of what meditation is. So what happens? If you understand what I'm saying, now the most important time, what's in front of you is the most important thing in the world. All you need to do is to care for it. You start with your body, close your eyes. Your body's right in front of you. You've got to say care for it, relax it. Don't try and control it or cure it. And after a little while, the body really relaxes. It relaxes big time. Then, when the body's relaxed, you can let it go. Don't try and let go of something when it's still causing a problem. Then you've got like the past and future. How difficult is it to let go of your past? To stop worrying about the future? Whenever it's a problem, I try and find out why. One of the reasons is because we hate our past. We're scared of our future, that's hating the future. So, care for your past. Care for your future. Give it some kindness. It says negativity. Yeah, incredibly powerful that is. I've given that, there was a talk somewhere about people who've been tortured. Who, in my profession, come across all people. Refugees. I teach them to care for their memories of torture. Not try and get rid of them. That is just so revolutionary. You know it works. They take away the pain of what happened to them. And their memories, you're not trying to get rid of those memories. You're actually caring for them. They're you, they're who you are. Scary thing to suggest, but it works. When you're trying to get rid of things, you give them power. One of my favorite stories. From the sutras, I like the story. You know, sometimes I get bored too when I just say things without a story. So, this is the story of the monster who came into the emperor's palace. You know, some people said one of the reasons that you get lots of disciples is you treat people like children and tell them stories. And you know, I said, yes, exactly. So we all remember stories, we like stories, and it means that kids can come and enjoy what's being taught. Small kids and also big kids. The monster who came into the emperor's palace goes like this. The empress was away on business, and a monster came into the palace. The monster was ugly, frightening, stinky, made terrible frightening sounds. He was so frightening, so scary, much worse. When you get on Alien, I've never seen Alien, but apparently Alien is the worst, scariest monster anyone's ever come across. This monster makes Alien look like a pussycat. This was a real frightening monster. And all the security is supposed to guard the place, the soldiers, the police, they hid under the table, they went in the broom cupboards, they hid behind the flower pots, they were so scared when they should have been protecting the place. Because that was a frightening, scary monster. And that allowed the monster to go right into the center of the palace, into the main room, and sit on the empress's chair on her throne. Imagine someone did that in Buckingham Palace. Sat on Queen Elizabeth's throne. All of the guards would come to their senses and say, "Get out! You're not allowed to come in here. We'll call the SAS. You got SAS? Yeah, okay. Who's your most frightening soldiers? Is it the SAS? Yes. Oh, very right. Really? Oh, come on in the SAS.
I'm calling private security. I'm calling the Marines. Get out! And those few unkind words, unkind thoughts, the monster just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And that just made all the security even more angry. And after about half an hour, the Empress came back. And his monster was huge. And his monster was so ugly. And his monster was so smelly. And I say that there were maggots crawling over his body who threw up. Even maggots could not, could not stomach the smell of this monster, let alone human beings. And the Empress took one look at that monster. She was wise. She was a Buddhist. So she knew exactly what to do with monsters. You know what she said? Welcome. The door of my palace is open to you, monster. Has anyone got you anything to drink? Anything to eat? We've got lots of special teas. We've got coffee. We've got latte and cappuccino and special ground. I don't even know my coffee. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. If we're in Australia, say, do you want a beer? And she was so nice to that monster that the monster grew an inch smaller. Less ugly, less offensive, less smelly. And everybody realized their fault. They were getting angry at the monster instead of being kind. So, they all tried to help the monster as much as they can. One of them sent out for a pizza, monster size. Can you get monster size pizzas in England? It's one of the sizes you get in Australia. You can order monster pizza. So I said, lucky for monsters. I don't know very much in this life, but I do know that it's amazing what food you can get these days. Somebody told me you can get long life milk. Add years to your age. That's my secret of age. Long life milk. 3 months of long life milk, you're going to live a long life. That's what it says on there. That's what it says on there. Now the package, long life milk, for long life. Okay. So anyway, someone gave him a foot massage, someone gave him a neck massage. They were so kind to this monster. Every kind act, kind deed, kind word, kind thought, the monster shrank a bit smaller. Until the monster was the same size as when it first came in. But it carried on with the kindness. Until soon, the monster was so small, one more act of kindness, and the monster vanished completely away. That was based on a story in the Devaputra Samyutta in the Buddha Sutras. The Buddha called these anger-eating monsters. They eat and thrive on negativity. Cancers are anger-eating monsters. Get out of my body, you don't belong. Again, it's a radical idea. Are supported by many oncologists I know to make friends with your tumor. Welcome, tumor. Thank you for coming to visit me. I'm not going to ask you to get out. Just stay as long as you like. Radical, but effective. The tumors shrink. You're not feeding them. Tumors are stress. Otherwise known as anger-eating monsters too. But also, any problems in your meditation are anger-eating monsters. Get out of here, restlessness. Get out of here, tiredness. Get out of here, stupidity in my mind. They just get bigger and worse. Say, welcome. Thank you for visiting me. Care for them. Don't try and get rid of them. That's the Empress of Questions. Now most important time, whatever it is, don't choose what you're aware of. That's more work. Just be aware, give it importance, and be kind. So, what happens? The body relaxes, the mind relaxes,
And because the body relaxes, you're kind to the past, you're kind to the future, it's not a problem anymore. Don't try and get rid of the past. Just be kind to it. And then it softens it until it's so easy it just vanishes. Don't try and get rid of the future. It's worry. Be kind to it. Now, one of the reasons of being kind to the future means, I don't always see the wrong side of the future. Something terrible is going to happen. It's going to be bad. I can't do this. This is going to hurt. Be kind to the future. Maybe it won't hurt. If it does, never mind. I will still love you, future. Your past, be kind to the past. You maybe give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Maybe you weren't so bad. Maybe he wasn't such a bad husband. Never mind. Be kind. Be forgiving. When you soften the past, it's so easy to let it go. When you're kind to the future, Brexit, it won't be that bad. Be kind. And then it's not a problem anymore. You can let it go easily. There's no way you can let go of the past or the future if it's heavy and big and strong and powerful. You've got to soften it, first of all, with kindness. And kindness does that. It's wonderful just how in my life you can be kind to all sorts of things. There's one of the monks who came to my monastery, I think you probably all know who he is. He's the one who pats king cobras. King cobras. One of the most aggressive and venomous snakes in Thailand. He was meditating in the forest. And heard the sound of a big animal. He opened his eyes, and many other monks opened their eyes so they could confirm what happened. This huge black king cobra came right up to the monk. In that part of northeast Thailand, that snake had a nickname. It was called the one-step snake. It was called a one-step snake because once it bit you, you only had one step and then dead. That's how venomous it was, the one-step snake. And so it came right up to him, lifted up his head, about this far from the monk's nose. Opened his throat. I don't know, it's supposed to be defense to make people afraid, but I actually quite enjoy it. People like a bit of sort of drama. Right from the monk's nose. What would you do if that was you? Don't ever think of outrunning a snake. And I've seen them, and I was in jungle time, 9 years. In Sri Lanka, probably the same. Incredible, those snakes can outrun Usain Bolt. Easy. That really was scary when I saw how fast snakes could run. And even snakes could swim as well, amphibious snakes. Never saw that before. They're fast. So no use trying to outrun a snake. And a snake's right in front of you. So this monk really admired him. He lifted up his hand and patted the snake on the head. Thank you so much for paying me a visit. Thank you, nice snake. He actually did that. And the snake never bit him. It's obvious why, because it's so hard to get a good pat these days for a snake. Human beings, it is so stupid. I'd rub my hand with patty, wouldn't you? No, yeah, that's nice. So the snake, oh yeah, that's nice. Thank you so much. There's no fear but loving kindness. And so the snake was enjoying having his head patted for about 2 or 3 minutes, and then closed its hood, went down and went to visit one of the other monks there. Lifted up his head, opened his hood, and that second monk said, no, go back to him. I'm not doing that. But that's a wonderful thing about sort of kindness. That nothing hurts you. The farmer's vanish. You can take an angry snake and turn it into a little pet. You can take a defilement and it just disappears with kindness. Try it. The snakes of the past, the snakes of the future, just soften up and vanish. So that is actually how we let go of the past and future, by softening them with kindness, caring for them, and then they disappear. So the past and future is gone, and your body is relaxed. So what happens next? When I went to that monastery, Frostworth Hall, many years ago, I said that's where they banged one back with a stick. They were teaching a type of meditation I'd never done before, and the same meditation. And they didn't give any instructions, keep your eyes open, facing the wall. I was willing to do anything. So I didn't know what I was doing, but facing the wall, with my eyes open, after half an hour, the wall vanished. And that was really cool. That was freaky. This was the 60s and 70s, but anything weird was really fabulous. We sought out weirdness. I just met in Cambridge with one of my best friends. Now we went ghost hunting together. Now for the Cambridge Psychic Research Society. He's still there, Fletcher, professor of theoretical physics as well, Queen Mary College. So we wouldn't run away from ghosts. When we heard the mighty one there, we ran towards the ghost, the opposite direction to most people. And I like to discover real things in life. And you know, many weird stories, you know, living in time for so many years. And I'm going to tell the story to about the gurus. I think I was in Indonesia. Now, you know, in Buddhist mythology, they have these big birds called gurus, mythical birds. Huge bird. They named the Indonesian airline after it, Garuda. It's supposed to be a mythical bird. I've seen them. I'm honest, okay? One of the weirdest times of my life. In this monastery in the north of Thailand, jungles, mountains, really remote, meditating one afternoon, and then you can always tell if you're sensitive that something's up. Electricity in the air, there's something strange, you're sensitive enough. So I got out of my meditation, out of my hut, and I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. Never seen anything like it in my life. Every bird in the forest was out there flying. You know, this big open sky, you know, every square inch was filled with a bird. The whole sky was full, no vacant place at all there in the sky. And in between was these two massive birds, bigger than eagles. I actually saw a king eagle over in Norway, walking in the mountains, and this big eagle, about the size of a man, was just standing there, perched, frightened the hell out of me. I just turned around very quietly and walked away. That could take you out so easily, a king eagle. Majestic. It's so beautiful. But anyway, these are amazing birds. I've never seen anything like it in my life. Gliding through the sky, and all the birds following. I really wish, you know, in those days, what was that, 1978 or something, really wish you'd have a camera to shoot something like that. Unbelievable but true. There we go. Those days in the forest, the jungles. Ooh, weird stuff. But anyway, the wall disappeared. And I thought, wow, what's going on? I was a scientist, use your logic. Soon became very obvious. Your brain is only wired to notice things which change. The sound of, there's actually an aircon on some family somewhere. The hum? Can you hear the hum? You won't be able to hear it for much longer. After a while, if it doesn't change, the brain says not important and turns off, doesn't notice it. The saliva in your throat, after a while, it's there, you can feel it now. A few more seconds and it will disappear. Your brain is wired only to notice things which change. So for me, in that monastery, looking at a blank wall, nothing was happening, and after a while, the wall vanished. The brain turned off the seeing. So, it's exactly what you do. I recognised afterwards, that's what happens when you close your eyelids. I can see the inside of my eyelids. After a few seconds, I can't even see that. The sense of sight turns off because you are still. If you don't have too much sound, after a while, the sound sense turns off. It's not needed anymore. So you don't have to be even in a forest, in a cave, to meditate. As long as the ambient sound, the background sound, doesn't change too much, after a while you can't hear anything. Smell, as long as no one passes wind, you won't, so the sense of smell will turn off. That's usually why people in the old days would burn incense. Because people's hygiene was not so good, so that way there's a constant smell in the meditation room, which means that you wouldn't smell anymore. It is the taste, that soon disappears. Four of the senses, gone. And if you can be kind to your body, and relax it, keep it still, your body disappears. This is what's supposed to happen in meditation. You can't feel your legs. They're gone. You can't feel your hands. They disappeared. You can't feel your back. Vanished. You can't feel your head. It's not there anymore. And the only thing left moving, your breathing. When I first went to Perth, in Australia, we got an invitation to meditate in one of these flotation chambers. Sensory deprivation units. So, there was salty water, you had to wear bathers. Salty water so you floated. And it's warm body temperature. So when you're floating, there's no pressure on any part of your body. No, not cold, not heat. So it was really comfortable. It was soundproof, you couldn't hear anything. It was a nice flow of air so you didn't suffocate. All your senses were suppressed. It was dark. Couldn't see, couldn't hear. The body was supported in salty water, which is at room body temperature. And they invited the monks to test it out for meditation. I couldn't wait to meditate in the flotation chamber, but I never got my chance. I had one monk who was senior to me, he got in there first. And the next morning, we saw the newspapers. Flotation chambers, as used by Buddhist monks. They conned us, invited us to test it out so they can use it in their advertisements. So I was told, no, I can't do it. I was really disappointed, but never mind. When I asked the monk what it was like, he said, oh yeah, this is so comfortable. No aches in the legs or the knees or the back. Not cold, not hot. But he said, in there it was so noisy, even though it sounded good. All he could hear was his breathing, because that's the only thing left. When everything else was taken out, his brain became so sensitive to his breathing. Now, use that as a stimuli for this meditation. Once the other parts of the body, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, the other parts of touch are taken out, the last thing which is left is your breath. It's natural. But if you stop the breath and make it still, there will be trouble. You're dead, baby. You're dead. And that's not a very nice thing for the organizers to deal with. So, please don't mind this meditation. So how can you get even more still? What happens is you're watching your breath because you're not doing anything, not thinking, not remembering, not putting any effort. It means that you are not using up energy, which means you don't need so much oxygen. You're not using your car, so it's just purring over, you're not using gas. Because you're not using oxygen, the breath becomes more soft. Because it becomes more soft, it's easier, it's calmer to watch. And little by little, your breath gets softer and softer and softer and softer until it disappears. It vanishes. So you can't feel your breath anymore. It's still going in. Your soul lies. This is that time in meditation when your five senses have settled down. And vanish. Oh, what bliss. Even when I was young, still had aches and pains and itches and mosquito bites. This is how I had to learn how to endure the mosquito bites in the jungles of Thailand. As soon as you sat down, they swarmed on you. You are lucky you have hair. I have bald head. More seats at the dinner table for mosquitoes. And they swarmed over you. And I wasn't used to them. And there were so many used to count of 60 or 70 at a time. That was so hard to bear. Until I did my meditation so I couldn't feel the body anymore. Just the breath. Until the breath got so still, couldn't even feel the breath anymore. That's how you can meditate for a couple of hours in mosquito-ridden jungles. And an interesting thing which happened afterwards. Usually, you know, you've been to, maybe not the Sri Lankans here, but the Westerners, Europeans. Whenever you go to these countries, you get a mosquito bite, and you get a little bump, a little welt on your skin. No Thai people never got that, they were used to it. But we did. But I'm really itchy for days afterwards. But after I got into these meditations, I looked at my arm and my head, not one welt on it. I thought, wow, this is the psychic power of deep meditation. When you do that, anything heals. And actually, I found out afterwards, it's not psychic at all, it's just science. Because apparently, mosquitoes are attracted to carbon dioxide coming out of your pores. So the higher your metabolism, the more you worry, the more you do, the more anxious you are, the more those mosquitoes know you're there. When you're really frantic about mosquitoes biting you, it's like you're putting up a red neon sign, I'm here, come have lunch. But when you're calm and peaceful, your metabolism goes down so much, mosquitoes don't know you're there. You become invisible. There's hardly any carbon dioxide coming out of your skin. They can't find you. And apparently that's what was happening. You're sitting in a mosquito-ridden jungle and mosquitoes couldn't find you because you were still. The sign of carbon dioxide was not there. So it's wonderful being able to do that. But this is what meditation is. Becoming so still, your body vanishes. What comes up next? The mind, the sixth sense. Greeks have six senses, Asians, Buddhist, Chinese have six senses. In the West, we're missing a sense. We're very deprived. We haven't got enough senses as Asia. And the sense that the West is missing is their common sense, according to Aristotle. That's what Aristotle called the mind, common sense. Because whatever you see, you hear, you smell, you taste, you touch, the mind also knows. Aristotle called it common sense. So when we only got five senses, we deny the existence of a separate sense called the mind, we've lost our common sense, we've also lost our mind. Now that explains so much about Western problems. Infecting other people, colonized people. So sometimes I tell people that's why I have to keep going to places like Singapore, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Hong Kong to redress the bad karma of my ancestors in colonizing those places. That's a big joke. But anyhow, the mind gets still and then the beautiful light appears in the mind. Nimittas. You're seeing your mind for the first time. That is not so hard to do. Never ever think, oh, that's high meditation, only for monks and nuns. That is for everybody. Standard Buddhist meditation practice. Being self-aware, and then you go so much, being still, for all your five senses get settled down, and you start to see your mind. A light. Disc. Beautiful. If you have been beautiful. This is where your silence during the retreat, your kindness, your generosity, your basic goodness, if you are a pure-hearted person, when that light comes up and it's actually gorgeous. Because you're a gorgeous person. What do I mean by that? Standard virtue. Kind. Generous. Oh, if you want the seat, please take it. If you want an extra cup of tea, please have one. That's what good people are. Selfless, kind, always there to help and serve others. Those sorts of people have got beautiful minds. And now you see it. Your mind is gorgeous. If you have been selfish, angry, you will find that light is like a dirty cloth. Imagine you have a dishcloth, you wipe the dishes, you wipe the table, it's got stains all over the place. The first time I told that in Malaysia, this meditator came up, he was really disturbed. He said, I just been meditating, I saw a white limiter and it was really dirty. So yeah, what have you been doing? Yeah, that's a problem, I'm sorry. You can't hide it anymore. You see how pure you are. Which is why being a good person, precepts, kindness, generosity, forgiveness, all the things, service, all the things which people understand, whatever culture is goodness, is important meditation. Good, kind person, forgiving, looking after others, not thinking of yourself. Now you get the first paycheck for that. Beautiful limitless. This is a sign your mind is becoming focused, still, bright and joyful. And also, when those limitless start coming up, that's probably the first time you experience just how beautiful this meditation is. There you start getting into the blisses of the mind. Wow, this is good. Wow, I can stay with this for a while. Wow. That's actually what it's like. You know that sometimes people think religion is endurance, you know, asceticism, pain. And, you know, for me, I could never do that. The reason I went to Thailand to become a monk, instead of Sri Lanka, was the Sri Lankan monks at Chisikihara at the time were miserable. I'm sorry, I'm being honest. They were never smiling, never happy, always scolding you. The Zen monks were far worse. I'd never go to Japan to become a monk, hitting you all over the place. Burmese, you know, couldn't raise a smile out of them, they were just also so sick. They were more like robots. Watch your breath. Don't sort of make your precepts. They were just hardly respond at all. So they had a lot. They went to see some Thai monks, and they were smiling. I thought, that's the monks for me. When I went to the Akhen Shah, he was the happiest person I've ever seen. I thought, well, that's what I want for a teacher. Just like the washing machine, washing powder commercials on TV. You wanted to see whether that washing powder washed whiter than every other powder. And I wanted to see whether this meditation works by seeing the final result. And Ajahn Chah, well, yeah, if that's the final result of meditation, I'm in. Happiness, joy, peace. So, this is your first taste of that. Happiness. Meditation is supposed to be happy. For those of you who doubt me, you can see the Dhammacharya Sutta here. Dhammacharya Sutta. Where, this is from the time of the Buddha, one of the Buddha's chief supporters, the king of Kosala, went to visit the Buddha, and he was in the monastery, found the Buddha's place where the Buddha was, went to see him and said, how much he enjoyed coming to the Buddha's temple. Why do you keep enjoying coming to this temple, O king? And the king replied, because when I come into this temple where you live, all the monks are happy and smiling. That's why he wanted to come often. If you had a choice of going to a temple, a church, a mosque, if everyone was miserable, would you like to go there? Of course not. You're miserable enough. You just go to the office to see that. So, go to a place where people are happy and cheerful. That was the monasteries. And know what the Buddha said? He said, yes, that's what you can expect when people's meditation is taking off. When they're getting insights, when they're meditating properly. Happiness. Please come in. No worries. You are welcome. So this is actually what happens when a person learns how to meditate. They get happier and happier and happier. And I can tell how your meditation is going. Not by what you tell me. I look for the meditation indicator. The smile. More smile means more deep meditation. This is not a joke. It's not some new age stuff. This is real from the time of the Buddha. Really happy. Why do you think that path took off so fast in those days? Because we've been so impressed by all these happy men and women who had nothing except happiness and power. So, if you follow these instructions, simple, now is the most important time. Whatever's in front of you is the most important. And just be kind. You do that for an hour, and you'll find you're happy. Aware, awake, alive. Easy. But incredibly powerful. Which is why I get overworked teaching. Sometimes I wonder, why on earth are other people teaching this? It's so simple. It's so effective and so powerful for anybody. And these days I can't tell who's going to do it, who's going to make it. A couple of years ago, a guy came into our retreat centre, full of tattoos, long hair, big guy. And about a few kilometres down the road from our monastery, there's a prison. I saw him, I said, you've got the wrong place, prison's up the road. He said, no, I'm on your retreat, he said. Oh, I make mistakes stereotyping people by their looks. He was the last person to ever expect to come on a retreat. Like a health angel. Like someone you wouldn't want to meet on a Saturday night in a dark car. So, he came on my retreat. And after 4 or 5 days, he came to see me, interviewed. And he blew my mind. To what he described, nimitta, bliss, the whole works, he'd had a jhana. And that really amazed me. It showed how easy it is for anybody. This was a rough, tough guy. But each of you had to follow instructions. And my goodness, it worked. So, you can do that too. Bliss out, for goodness sake. And if anyone has ever been taught, oh, if you experience joy, you get attached. And attachment is suffering. No, that is more bullshit. Pasadika Sutta, the Buddha's teachings, anyone who gets attached to the bliss of meditation, they will have 4 possibilities. This is what happens if you get attached to the bliss of meditation. You've got letting go of it. Yeah, please do. If you get attached to the bliss of meditation, it's either stream-winning, white-returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment, the 4 stages of enlightenment. So said the Buddha. That's powerful. This is a happy part, a bliss part. So, get into it and have fun. Okay, I better stop now, go with the flow, because people don't need to go to the toilet. Please go to the toilet and have a pause for 10 minutes, 10 minute toilet break. Walking meditation. Now, we're doing walking meditation to the toilet and walking meditation back. 2 simple. And I'll do 10 minutes.